The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good morning. Spring, huh? All around us. It's amazing you were able to tear yourself away from spring and to come here for some time. I was just feeling that spring breeze. And I was thinking about, the people who were here before we came, before the Europeans came anyway, the Lenape. They lived in these long, low houses, these really long houses. What it must have been like. They were kind of dark when it was winter and early spring. And then on a day like this, what it must have been like for them to go out and all the natural, trees and plants and bushes that were here at that time. And just the fragrance of the blossoms must have been just far more amazing than it is for us, really. Back in those days, yeah. And, for many people, today we recognize as Palm Sunday, celebrated by Christians. It's a day of appreciation for that young rabbi, Jesus, as he rode a donkey into Jerusalem the last week of his life. In the story, the people were wanting to appreciate his teachings of peace and love, nonviolence. And so they spread these palm fronds on the streets, on the road. And he came in, symbolically expressing a humility, simplicity, by riding a donkey. He didn't come in on a heroic horse, came in on a little donkey. And you could say that that simple act of coming in on a donkey was an admonishment to the haughty powers in control, the state. Said that in those ancient times, the palm fronds represented goodness, and they were purity, and they were inscribed on coins and buildings. It was like a symbol that was commonly understood. And that symbol of goodness, peace, and love was to end a few days later in another story of great suffering, hatred, based on greed for power on the part of his tormentors. And very sadly, Jesus' wonderful teachings have been used through the years to create even more hardship and suffering to many peoples, all based on that greed, hatred, separation. It's tragic. It's tragic to think about and then to contemplate that this is a story that continues to be reborn today for us. Poverty, violence, oppression. We just have to look at the newspapers, if you still look at newspapers, or your devices, or what you hear. Or just look at the people who are sleeping on the streets in this town, in this capital city, down the street. the anger and frustration that we hear expressed. The crisis on our border. And the rage in the heartland. Unbelievable greed and corruption here and around the world. So we are haunted by the ancient Buddhist teaching that all of life is heir to the three poisons: greed, anger, and ignorance. We want what we do not have, or we think that we do not have enough of. We become angry and we hate others. And we are ignorant because we don't recognize our interrelationship, our interconnection with everything. We don't realize that we're not separate. So we make an other and we oppress the other. And sometimes we may even see that all that nexus that come from the ancient teachings really directed inward to ourselves too. Those same issues of greed, anger, and ignorance directed inward. So the teaching is that that is of the nature of being human. It's not that we're going to fix that. We can see it in the animal world. If you can look carefully, you can see it in the plant world. The struggle to survive. As Tennyson had it, everywhere we look is nature red in tooth and claw. Nature bloody, he is saying, in tooth and claw. Very famous phrase. When you see plants invading one another's territory, you have to recognize that there's something there that's going on. And of course, if we look at our world today, unrelenting suffering of beings and the planet itself. And what is our place in this? What is our responsibility as being part of this interconnectedness, this third aspect? Can we ignore the suffering? Is it possible to do anything? Is it possible to hide? These are impossible questions. We can't run away from them. So I go back to the ancient Buddhist archetypes, trying to find a way to face these impossible questions personally, for me. What can I do? How can I position myself? So what I think is, first of all, we need to consider ourselves, to identify ourselves as bodhisattvas. And then act as bodhisattvas. So, if you may know or you may recall that bodhi means light, as in being able to see clearly, to discern, to function with light, to share light. And sattva means simply someone who is, a being. So light beings. In the early English translations, you know, they always translated as an enlightened being. But I much prefer enlightening being. There's a little more, there's energy there, gerund. Let's go with enlightening. It's not just enlightened, me, me, me. The enlightening, offering light. So how could we do that? How can we function in this world? I'm going to offer a couple of stories today that use the really poetic imagery and of the Mahayana tradition, the symbolic richness that you find there, as a way to help us somehow find our way into responding to today's cries of help, for help. So the first thing is that we mustn't allow ourselves to get discouraged. That usually happens when we become focused on a specific outcome. We need to keep our vision wide, open to new ways of working. Don't think that the work will be done once we get this thing done. So there's an old story I love that gives this teaching. It's about Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva. Bodhisattva of compassion. Her name originally in the Sanskrit means the one who looks down, as in looking down on the suffering of the world. And when her name was translated into Chinese, Kuan Yin, it became the one who listens to the cries of the world, the one who hears the cries of the world. And she's represented visually, or he is represented visually. It's different traditions show this figure with different genders, but sometimes a male figure, sometimes a female figure, sometimes you can't tell whether it's a male or female figure. Sometimes sitting on a lotus, symbol of enlightenment, sometimes holding a child. Sometime with many arms and hands, holding various tools to serve with. My favorite image of all. He's got a little lasso and a shovel and a rake, and a credit card. I mean, we need to make our own images, don't we? And the male renderings of Avalokiteshvara show him looking down, holding tools to be of service, those who are suffering. And also, both in the male and female images, sometimes Avalokiteshvara has many heads. You seen those? 9 or 11 heads, one on top of the other. And there's a great story about that. Once Avalokiteshvara saw all the suffering in the world, the suffering perceived to be caused by the demons of hatred and greed and ignorance that I was talking about earlier. And Avalokiteshvara saw how these demons were torturing sentient beings. And so Avalokiteshvara entered into battle with these demons and stopped all the torture and violence, stopped it all. And then she turned to Amitabha. Amitabha is the universal Buddha, whose name means immeasurable light. She turned to Amitabha and said, "Look, I've saved them all." Imagine that moment. Satisfaction. You look down, you see all this suffering, and you evaporate all the demons, and the sentient beings are no longer suffering. Look, I've saved them all. But then Amitabha said, "Look behind you." And when she looked, she saw a whole wave of new suffering arising. More demons, more greed, more anger, more ignorance, more suffering. She couldn't believe it. She was filled with anguish and despair. And she screamed, "Ah!" And her head broke into millions of pieces. You ever felt that way? And it's said in the story that Amitabha, you know, was freaked out. And started gathering the pieces together to try to put them back, but he became quite confused and he wound up with 9 heads. And that's how we have our 9-headed Avalokiteshvara. And it's said that after that she learned the lesson, or he learned the lesson, that there's no end to the demons, no end to the suffering. Avalokiteshvara simply continues to serve, using all those heads, all those arms, all those eyes, to stop the suffering at this time, in this moment. She continues to serve today. We can't be discouraged, or we'll lose our heads like Avalokiteshvara did. And I really think it's a wonderful teaching, because when we realize that we won't permanently fix ourselves, our loved ones, the climate, the political system, all the suffering in the world, then we no longer become discouraged. We no longer become depressed and paralyzed. Instead, we're free to act in the moment, to respond to what's in front of us, to serve the vast network of life. And we're empowered to work with others to make a difference, to not think it's only our way. And our service does not depend on our particular view of how things must be done and exactly what must be done. But rather, our energy is around service. To be of service, to step in. And then we're not discouraged because we're working with others. And we're free to act within that vast network of others who are also acting. We are not ignorant of our interconnection with all beings. So it's rather than being caught in our view of the way things must be, we can think of our work as service by stepping in paying attention, and working with others. And that releases our energy. Moves us toward more understanding, toward even those we consider our, quote-unquote, our enemy, those ones that are, we think are our the demons out there. And we have to really guard against that. I have to guard against that. It's so easy because most of the stories about what's happening in the world are slanted to what we want to hear. Generally, you know, I mean, the newspapers that we buy, the magazines that we read, the inputs that we get are all based on our own biases. And so they're kind of like, they are likely to increase our disdain for those who don't agree with that opinion. So we have to be very careful not to unwittingly, you know, create more suffering through our prejudice and bias against those who see other ways of living and working. We can't lose our head. So, you know, I was recently asked a really terrific question. Actually, it wasn't recently, it was a while back, but it popped up when I was thinking about this problem that we have. And the question is, why do bodhisattvas have more fun? You know, we take our service work so seriously, our citizen work, our compassion and action serious. Why would bodhisattvas have more fun? And what is that fun? Isn't it a kind of delight in life? In the breath? In the unraveling quality of time? In the early morning light? The delicacy of the breeze right now? The look on the face of a child when you smile at them. The fist bump on the street. I mean, that's great. That'll last a block and a half. Just feels good. The kindness you're offered. It's writing that letter to people in solitary. Visiting your friends at Sing Sing Prison. That's happening today. Some of our members are up there now. Joining with others to change the legal practices here in the city. We've been quite successful. There is change. Writing letters to parole boards. That's fun. When I write a letter to, wrote that letter recently that we were asked to do, you know, I imagined the parole board sitting there and I'm trying to write this letter that will somehow seduce them into granting parole, being kinder, realizing people make mistakes, change happens. Speaking up in meetings. Accompanying immigrants to hearings. That's fun. Ask Barry, he's been doing that. Jacqueline, I think you do that too. Accompany immigrants. You've got one guy, one person. Right? It's fun. Because you're not frozen in this attitude about the way things are. Instead, you're in motion. And obviously, what gets in the way of a bodhisattva having fun? It's getting attached to the idea of how it should be. The idea of attaining something. And in the old days, they particularly talked about, well, that was the great wisdom and joy of the bodhisattva, was the bodhisattva was not trying to attain enlightenment, but merely expressing enlightened conduct. Such a difference, huh? Not fixed, but expressing, alive. Getting fixed on some static idea of getting enlightened. That's what Trungpa Rinpoche called spiritual materialism. That's getting materialistic about your state of mind. So that's how I'm conceiving of this kind of role of the contemporary bodhisattvas. We're not fixated on attaining a specific agenda item. We may agree on the principles of a Green New Deal or health care for all or reparations for slavery. We may agree on the principle, but we cannot be stuck on point A1, or we'll lose it all. And we'll lose our enlightening sense, our openness to what is arising in the moment and what is possible to do. To be open and creative is what today's bodhisattvas do when they are embodying their energy. So I have to see with fresh eyes all of the conflicts that create suffering here. We don't want to lose our heads. Instead, we're looking for more imaginative ways to approach the suffering we behold. And there's another way that the bodhisattvas have more fun. And that's by realizing and responding to the core Buddhist principle of samsara is nirvana. Samsara typically means your everyday, ordinary life. Getting up, setting the alarm, making the coffee, coming to the zendo. Samsara. Go to work. Come home. And nirvana is often referred to as a kind of a transcendental state where there's no suffering. The word samsara is from the Sanskrit word samsara, which means revolving, moving around, not static, but moving. And, in ancient Buddhism and Hinduism, it referred to rebirth cycles. And for us today, it's the way to really recognize that everything is shifting and changing all the time, that we are not the same as we were when we walked in this room a few hours ago. Because of the tooth and claw reference, I found myself reading Tennyson the other day, and he wrote about samsara in a way. He said, "The hills are shadows, and they flow from form to form, and nothing stands. They melt like mist, the solid lands. Like clouds, they shape themselves and go." This amazing vision of, it sounds like Dogen, very much, the Mountain and River Sutra, Tennyson sees the movement and the change of mountains and rocks and rivers, just like clouds. And that's what bodhisattvas can also recognize and helps them to have a joy in life instead of the grimness that we find so often in proponents of change. We are serving in time, now, all together, because we have more fun. We can appreciate the preciousness of our lives, the spark of just this moment. Not agonizing about how can I serve, how can I make a difference. Instead, picking up the tool at hand. It's a cup. It's a hard question. But I think having hard questions is more fun than easy ones. I think of an old image in the Astarashika Sutra, which is Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines, which is a precursor to the Diamond Sutra. It came a century or so before. And there's this wonderful image of people gathered at riverside. And there's a bodhisattva that comes and who is piloting a ferry boat. It's full of people. And this ferry boat is going from one side to the other. The symbol, of course, of crossing the sea of suffering. And here's what it says. I've changed the gender because that's what we're doing these days. She courses in dharmas as empty, signless, and wishless, but she does not experience the blessed rest, nor does she course in a sign. As a skillful fairy woman goes from the shore to this shore to the other shore, but also does not stand at either end, nor does she stand in the great flood. Listen again. He courses in dharmas as empty, signless, and wishless. Heart Sutra, you hear in the background of that? He courses in dharmas as empty, signless, and wishless. But he does not experience the blessed rest, nor does he course in a sign. He doesn't get stuck in a sign, in a word, my way. As a skillful ferryman goes from this shore, the shore of suffering, to the other shore, the shore of samsara is nirvana, but also does not stand, isn't stuck, at either end, nor does he stand in the middle, in the flood. It is a marvelous passage about a life of service, carrying yourself and others across the sea of suffering, not getting stuck in the idea of I am crossing the sea of suffering, or not getting caught in the idea of suffering or sea. That's what all this business about the sign is. It is the wisdom and compassion of service, yes, but also to live that life, to meet the inevitable changes that life offers, and just continue to practice, to be alive to it. He courses in dharmas as empty, signless, and wishless. She recognizes the momentariness, the signlessness, you know, it's not getting stuck. What does she do? She navigates across the river of suffering, shore to shore, not stopping on this shore or in the river itself. Constantly being present to life itself as time flows on. Being able to adjust to the changes, the political changes that we see around us, to shift and play with it, to not get stuck my way. You could say we're all in this ferry boat together. We're all making our way across the sea of life, the sea of suffering and its temptations. And, you know, I think we need to break out of some sort of rigid solemnity about what we're doing. It's fun. Bodhisattvas have more fun. So here's my closing gatha. Get in the boat, the water's rising. All together now, row, row, row across this sea of suffering.